Welcome to the Cascadian Prophets Podcast, a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, empowering people to practice poetry and deepen connections to place, self, and the present moment.
It may have taken 60 years, the deaths of her sister and mother, and a season of catastrophic forest fires to bring it out, but Roxy Power has a book of poems, and it is entitled The Songs That Objects Would Sing. A poet, performer, and labor activist, a professor at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and a Cornell alum, of Roxy Power, Cecil Giscombe wrote that these poems, quote, will brush the reader with a difficult and worthy joy. Indeed, they're filled with lament, a poetics that are alive and conscious, and even a bit of awe for all the transient things in our world, including capitalism. Roxy, what a joy to talk to you here in the Zoom room about your fine work.
Thanks, Paul, and always very happy to talk with you about all things poetry. I do feel a bit intimidated by the fact that the very first thing you said was it took me 60 years to get this book out, but I'm going to try to see that in light of, I don't know, the cask of Amontillado or something, that it's very fine and precious how long it has been sitting there fermenting, so to speak, into the brew that it is today. We'll hope.
Most poets get their books out before age 60. So I was really kind of playing off that fact. And my first question was, why so long to have a book?
Oh, God. Okay. I might as well wrangle with the devil right off the bat. My excuse is that I'm not very good at self-promotion. I have hundreds of poems kind of I don't want to say like Emily Dickinson, because nobody's like her, but sitting in a, not in a trunk, but in a Google file, and sending them out, you know, for those $30 a pop contests is untenable for some of us. And even though I've been writing for years about the value of social networks, such as that which was founded in the 60s by the second generation New York School of Poets, who all sat together like Ted Bergen and Ann Waldman and gang, read each other's poems and published them the next day on mimeograph machines. And I do have my own social networks. I'm still hesitant for some reason to put myself out there. I do work for other people for the most part. I've done two huge transgenre anthologies with 150 people per pop. I've been a labor organizer for 23 years on behalf of other people and so forth. And it's just maybe my weird Southern woman upbringing where the promotional ethos has been more toward other people, which in this world doesn't serve people that well. Also, it's just, you know, it's just very busy, this life I live, teaching, writing up at UC Santa Cruz and trying to advocate on behalf of precarious laborers and so forth. So that's my excuse and I'm sticking with it, but I'm getting going this year. And I've been doing lots and lots of events and performances and organizing them. Poetry and the InterArts event at UC Santa Cruz and the anthologies. And so once we get into it, hopefully we can talk about the relationship between writing and events, because I do see myself more in the lineage of Olson, who kind of characterized speech as a form of publication, even though it's not literally.
Well, that sounds like a fine follow-up topic to me. I mean, I was going to talk about your labor activism, because it seems to me when you are organizing that that's a full-time job. And so the time to write and then also to seek out publication is impacted by that. And I'm sure you'd probably say yes, but I like the idea of talking about the poetry life and events and the Olson thread. So why don't you just continue with that thread?
Well, the first iteration of the anthology series that I founded at UC Santa Cruz in 2007 called Viz InterArts was subtitled Event. And I subtitled that in relation to Henri Lefebvre, the situationist concept of the event as an action. Yeah, that one's called Interventions, but that is, in fact, yeah, you're holding up a copy of the second version. But the first one that I did was focused on the concept of event, trying to engage the paradox of publishing something which the surrealist Antonin Artaud said was by very definition unpublishable, uncapturable, and an event by nature is dependent upon a moment that can never be captured again, even if you video recorded it. Because you can't have that exact breath again. You can't have, you could die while you're, in fact, it felt like I almost did while publishing these anthologies. And so I oriented them much as you would an event. I wanted the reader to experience them as though they were an event, walking through the pages of it. And most of the work that I did, especially in the MFA program, was event oriented. I was that person who was always the performance poet. So I gravitated toward people like Bob Holman and others who, in the heady era of the late 80s, where speech was being derided by the language poets, took on the moniker of a speech-focused poet, very much influenced by music, very much influenced by the fact that I had started a feminist theater company in Colorado and wanted to take my poems and express them in that form. I mean, I'm sure that you're familiar with Olson's 1965 Berkeley Poetry Conference 8-hour unfolding of his head, you know, that was his preferred mode of presenting his poems, was in speech and going at the speed of speech, going on his nerves, and then trying to capture that energy of speech in the form of writing. So that's one thing I could say about my preferences.
You hit on another subject I wanted to talk about, and that is there are references to Miles Davis, Duke Ellington's Mood Indigo. I think that was referenced as your mom's favorite song. The Mamas and the Papas, John Coltrane, Disco Balls, I mean, just about everything. What role does music play in your poetry?
I think that I am shadow boxing with my unattained preferred identity as a musician. My mom was a musician, and in some ways, I didn't have a kernel for a mother like she did, who made her sit down at the piano and practice for several hours every day. My mom wanted to give me a lot more freedom to explore what I wanted to do, so she didn't make me practice, which I resent in some ways. But I don't know if I actually had the technical chops that she did. So I was constantly in my head, living in a musical, making up improvisational songs, much to everybody's annoyance. I might break out into one during our interview, who knows? But that's something that just comes to me naturally. Is songwriting. And so jazz being my favorite genre, which I probably inherited from my mother and other people, in part because though it has a structure, you're very familiar with this, a song structure, everybody is given what, 8-16 measures to improvise as they will. And I think that that's very much mirrors my poetry writing process, which is to go into a kind of trance, like state that is impacted by the need to move forward in that moment. So things spill out, probably influenced by forces that we don't really understand, like the unconscious, that are, you know, occasioned by what Wallace Stevens would call the cry of the occasion. You start out with a song structure or maybe a theme for your poem, which informs then the improvisational solos. So I'm comfortable with not knowing what's coming. And I don't think I did refer, by the way, to the Mamas and the Papas, did I? If I did, I certainly am shocked at myself. I think I referred to John Cage and Patti Smith.
Dream Miles a little Davis. Dream of me.
Who did that song first, though? Wasn't that Ella?
It was others have done it first. The Mamas and the Papas had a hit with it. And
okay.
You and I are about the same age, so I'm kind of going for my own stab at it. But, you know, it was worth a shot.
Brown, right? Yeah, go ahead.
You know, we met because of an affinity for a certain stance toward poem making, organic, projective, the practice of outside. I mean, you could use your own term, but can you talk about how you were initially exposed to that poetics, why it has power for you, and how it shapes your work, how it makes your work different from most of the work that you read?
When I was attending a Saturday morning poetry group called the Poetry Junkies, I learned about you. When I referenced Denise Levertov's essay, Notes Toward Organic Poetry, about a million times, and they said, God, you have to know Paul Nelson, whose entire Cascadia Poetics project seems to be oriented around the ideas inherent in that essay. So then I did reach out to you, and we did collaborate on a transgenre cabaret last year in Seattle at the AWP. A little bit about us. But in terms of Levertov, Olson, Duncan, and that whole crew, I would say that Black Mountain College, as soon as I learned about them through Nate Mackey, who came to Cornell in the late 80s when I was there working with Cecil Giscombe, who who was my boss for Epic Literary Magazine. And of course, Nate was teaching open field poetics at UC Santa Cruz, which ironically, years later, I came to teach here. When he had hip surgery, I stepped into his class and taught it more, tried to teach it for him. I resonated with this idea of the poem as a field that you walk into in some ways and discover by a careful contemplation of related objects in that field, call them rocks, call them, as Creeley would, I guess, a word can be an object and is placed there by the mind, not necessarily like you would if you were trying to build a house and all the rocks have to be lined up in just a way, but you're noticing a relationship between the rocks that exist there, perhaps. And you're drawing lines of connection between them like you would if you were staring up at a night sky and drawing connections between the stars and seeing your own image in that constellation. I'm interested in seeing those images and those new relationships between objects in a field of ideas, in a field of words, and placing them there as well. So I'm kind of caught in the flux between the Olsonian notion of the poem being made as quickly as the speed of thought and the Levertovian notion of the poem being received by an open mind that is paying attention to what wants to be born. Like you and I have talked about a lot, that her theory is more metaphysical, that poetry is revelation, right? Form is an extension of content, according to Creeley, which then Olson talked about in projective verse and verses. Form is a revelation of content, which presumes almost a metaphysical stance that the poem precedes your kind of giving birth to it. Somewhere in between those, it's almost like you're creating a baby as you're having it. I don't know if that's possible. But I was very drawn to those ideas that I was introduced to at Cornell and to the idea that you're in a community where you're working between art forms. Obviously, the happenings, Cage, Rauschenberg, Cunningham, Zanti Shawinski, all of them who were having these events nightly and making them up in some ways in response to whatever the zeitgeist was in the moment and trying to collaborate with one another, Buckminster Fuller's students who were trying to set up a whole geodesic dome in the field and letting it fail because it was too big. So people, only 50 of them, collaborating with one another and in a sense being naked psychologically in front of each other to try to essay something that hadn't been done before as a way of avoiding the fascistic tendencies of the day. It was Joseph and Annie Albers who fled Nazi Germany because they were working at Bauhaus to bring this ethos of creating something new, kind of like the Romantic poets, as a way of expressing, you know, democracy, exploring your imagination as the best expression of individuality. That was a mouthful, but yeah, I could go on and on. I guess I won't. But I have a whole Black Mountain College section in this event.
The event you spoke of. Here's the bookmark for it. No Irritable Reaching.
No Irritable Reaching. So, and the what do you mean the bookmark?
For the event you spoke of.
And that you're so kind, Paul. You're really one of the most generous collaborators, speaking of collaborations, that I know of. You're always bringing people together in events. The Cascadia Poetry Festival that I went to in October. And what amazing communities that you're always creating. And I feel very thankful to you for helping me to rhizomatically connect to Seattle, which was the title of the AWP panel that I was part of, was rhizomatic poetry communities. And I was very hopeful trying to build some of those rhizomes, those lateral root connections between specifically Pacific Coast communities, bioregionalism, all that stuff you're doing at Cascadia. I'm just south of Cascadia, but we have some poetic historical ties, our towns.
Well, there's no question. And Santa Cruz, of course, being a center for consciousness and the Bay Area. I know that Santa Cruz is not the Bay Area per se, but the Bay Area really being the cultural hub of the North American West Coast, the cultural center for a long time. I don't know if that's the case anymore. I don't even know where the center is, if there is one anymore, but that's a whole
other
story.
I think you're right. I mean, I lived for 88 years in the Bay Area, and I would say that the work that I was doing then whether or not it was with Poets Theater or Neo Benchi, which was something I was on the ground floor of live film narration, starting that with a group of experimental poets and just, working with bands. There's a lot going on in the Bay Area, more than in Santa Cruz, but as REM says in their song, stand in the place where you live. So I've been trying to do that more in recent years. So it's a very lively community here as well, but I agree, probably San Francisco and the East Bay are central. LA would beg to differ, but let them.
So would you be so kind as to read the title poem? I know it's a long poem, and I know you've read parts of it in interviews before, but I'd really love to hear the whole thing.
Wow. Sure. Thank you, Paul. The title poem, The Songs That Objects Would Sing, I started after my mom died. And it sort of unspooled across a summer. And I think it will keep unspooling. I think this is, I believe, possibly, I hope we'll see what happens, but the book by Rachel Blau Duplessis, the long essay on the long poem, she talks about long poems that maybe take shape over several books. So we'll see how this one goes. Imprints of the other world, stalks of yearning keen in the wind, connect down there to something. They dry out above but whistle a familiar but never heard tune. Blue streaks on the petals of night inflict us on our own drift for beauty. A line down the middle of the dream says, this diptych is safe to watch, but do not cross. Elemental drives pull us there against our will, but not so far. I'll speed along in this lane long as I can. Mortar inflicts a sense of placement, a there that's always been. Mixing and shaping and placing of bricks all forgotten once mortared. They are just there, as though they always have been. A place for the mind to rest, escape the panic of space. We were there together in a placement against all odds. What do we really know about starting from scratch in a bed, in a belly, in a bardo? No eye there yet, but reaching. Samsaric portal, countless eons? Better breathe and forget about it. So I had you for a lifetime and now cannot imagine what next. Read a book about what happens? Subscribe to a theory about how we'll meet again? Tired of all who pretend to know. I feel you in the glint of objects sometimes. That's all I know. That shimmer down the length of spider web, that omniscience in the chandelier unseen till now, but for a flickering instant, something. All is projection and mind play. I need you or stay, and the brass goes back to being just brass. If I let you watch me and loosen the grasp, I may see a twinkling again. Who knows? If I say I can't stop, perhaps I'll just keep going past parentheses, brackets, all manner of punctuation and transitional phrases into horizon, infinity's coda. If I say I can't stay here and finally footnote myself off the page while I know where to find the book where once I was a chapter, right now the view is anthology view, a grove of leaves. Through my window, vertical green and brown, redwood trunks, thick and high, block the sky. Foliate womb makes infinity cozy. I would commit to elegy, except the sonorous trickle of stream teases the mind back to a cusp. Whereon we launch our gratitude for options. That sound that dust makes as it coalesces into star. My dog's great ears pick up insect rattle and leaf stir. And someone hears those tiny yellow leaves sing themselves towards tomatoes' green beads. So is death then no song? Elegy fills the absence to soften fear's follicles just poking through. To say to my young daughter, watch or listen if you want to know what life is to say life is anxiety. Dog leaping toward bird sound, bird leaping from dog sound. Who sits absorbed inside sound's centerless, edgeless surround? If I could paint the so-called absence of sound, cages, silence, its impossibility, stemming from Rauschenberg's white paintings, there would still be the hum, the heartbeat, quiet, but not silent. So there are sounds that stand in for you. Some strange music drags me in. Just now it's dream a little dream of me. I see your knowing smile, hear your voice swing. Is this what the living do? Dream little dreams for those who cannot. Drawn deep into creekside locutions, I trust this continuity whose music cannot be rehearsed. Improvisation with certain stationary facts. A rock here and here with this rushet of water will likely make this tone. Last night's rain, a phenomenon of air meeting air like smiling strangers in a crosswalk. Some thunder that passes but leaves behind tomorrow's new song. The creekside song is different, yet the same. Same rocks tune different water until it lulls me to a forgetfulness Nietzsche said would heal. Looking back to better times, to monumental history when your mother was alive, or looking back like Orpheus, forever, an extension of the present moment and what is not there. To relate with you directly, a photo propped up by red birdhouse, your wistful garden of a smile, the last my eye recorded as you lay dying. I was not yet a warrior, and I'm not mostly. The world does not end, says a poet, and I say, which world? When I held you as you lay dying, when you died, when I held you in my arms, I had a dream of the warrior we all are, buried beneath the dream of permanence. I've never seen such a beautiful face, yours, steady in the moment that contains the entire past of it, all that was not. The depth of it drowns the book and can only be etched in bone or the stories that others will tell. I feel like everyone should get up and get a drink of water or something. It's a long poem. There we go. Take a breath. Prismatic life. Hold it up to the light. There is not one but many. When all things coalesce, when each strand retains its own, the path between earth and heaven painted by the messenger, Iris. And yet to describe it is, as Keats said, to clip an angel's wings, to unweave a rainbow. Seven colors like seven notes in a scale from hot to beyond deep blue. Mood, indigo, you used to play your favorite song and your sister's too. You'd play it until it sparkled, broke, and then you'd dance it blue. Oh, Mom, those fingers curved over my hand. I can feel your skin too tight over bones like leather gloves left out to dry after a rainstorm. The piano you thumped until it turned into story. Then the fingers dried up from disuse. And yet to see them, fragile and beautiful, pink half moon fingernails, artist's hands lying over my own is to sense beginnings and to have a song I could play one day. The shame of beauty, it doesn't know, it will not last forever. Its eyes grow sad as it sees this, then ripen underground into jewel-colored yams that will feed one of us one day. What will burnish the song to amber, frozen amber of all we ever were? It was just a moment, but it's what we have. Each leaf has a light side and a dark side. Each life, a mirror for the sun, and a shade for the dark forest floor. Each leaf, a story that was once not there and will not be again. We see the leaf and think it's there. Its thereness comes from being there now. Paltry imagination. Places where winter's memory is summer's goad help us to write the real, not wished for story of the leaf. Here the leaves are green and green and green without end. And I could be fooled into thinking it was impossible that you died. Stiff little moment, how to dance you into pliancy. Admiring that grandfather redwood preceded and will outlast me. Witness to a storm. Neurosis of Stellar's J. Its matrix shriek going out in all directions from a single point, an asterisk of sound, no apperception there. Who are the inward focused here, the cochineal among such racket makers, dipping inside to bear witness to one's own wells? The light now is an inner light. Patches of remnant sun on logs deep in the forest floor seem to radiate from within, equinox around the bend. Soft illuminated surround mocked by the racer's tail cutting up the oak leaves with its angry switching. My branch, my branch, my branch. How to re-enter the conversation with objects that bear your subtle signature, your cinematic fictions I sew from scratch inside this song-strafed foliate mosh pit. And so we undulate in time, you there, me here, orphan twine, a moon curtained by rain. Inside were framed by sullen window shades, while sultry emerald leaves drip future from the other side of the pane. If I hold my end up this side of the pane, can you rest folded in eternal thought? The counterbalance to forgetting is frottage, an apparition of what once was there, rubbed back into likeness enough to help us see it is no longer there. When I touch the objects that bring you to mind, touch upon them. When I touch your dust, your crumbs, when I... Like an archaeology of closed eyelids, candles once lit and frozen, the angel's lips open in a song she is about to but has never and never will sing. The mute acceptance of objects to receive our fragment song, a circle free of dust, once we lift and by lifting enter the story, replacing the clean halo with a mess of fictions that startle us back to grace. Wrapped, we listen to what never was and will be again.
A stunning poem.
Thank you, Paul.
I would commit to elegy except, seems like a potent elegy to me, but you're not going to commit to it. Can you unpack that a little bit? Page 3.
The next thing that happens, I think, is kind of the muse of the poem, which is, I would commit to elegy except the sonorous trickle of steam, sorry, stream, teases the mind back to a cusp we're on. We launch our gratitude for options. So as I'm sitting in a redwood forest, being influenced by the sound of something which embodies the very lightness of the very reality of change, it occurs to me that elegy as a form is almost too static for what I'm doing in the composition of this poem. I'm trying to enter into a conversation with impermanence rather than holding on. I mean, I'm holding on a lot. And at the same time, I feel like elegy is mostly about remembrance. And of course, remembrance of your own grief. But I think I'm trying to say things a little bit more philosophically about the nature of impermanence. And the Heart Sutra comes into play a lot here for the emptiness.
Yeah. Tired of all who pretend to know what's there, whether you'll meet again, whether you'll meet your mom again.
Well, it's easier to put a template of some ideological understanding on top of feelings that are almost too difficult to contain except in something that moves, because they're always changing from moment to moment. So if I think the form of a song or the form of a poem, which is, you know, captured in recordings and captured on the page, but by definition, non-static, a representation of a moment of composition, which is kind of like what a life is, or a memory of someone who's departed, or even a love. You know, it's impossible to freeze someone in a Shakespearean sonnet like he often tried to do. You can freeze, in a sense, you can record your feelings about that. But I feel sometimes guilty because I am a Buddhist, but as I've said before, I don't really know if there's reincarnation. I don't really know if there's karma. I can see some possible indication of it, but it is irritating when you're going through deep grief to hear how you'll meet somebody in heaven or be reborn and meet them again. Because what's most real is your feeling of bereftness and being in space. And so when I say I'm looking for objects to escape, for a place for the mind to rest, escape the panic of space, that's sort of what Tibetan Buddhists talk about in terms of the 49-day period after death, the bardo, where you're trying to not panic, especially in the moment of death. People practice that in meditations because that's the moment where you can incur the worst possible karma for the next most terrible, you know, iteration of your life. You're trying to calm yourself in the face of the unthinkable. Hmm. And so, like any poet, I guess I just stream some of those feelings through objects. Maybe not enough of them, though. And that's probably why I just need to keep going with this poem, because I think that I set the readers up to expect a few more actual objects here. It's somewhat abstract poem, isn't it?
It is a little abstract, but it would seem to me, to paraphrase Ezra Pound, that the abstractions are earned because it does have it is a high energy construct. And maybe because of your relationship with your mom, which I'd like to know about. Maybe it was because of your holding your dead mother in your arms. Were you there you were there at the moment of her death?
Oh yeah, I was, and I feel so honored. I think she wanted to slip away. I think, you know, she had, things were always happening throughout her life where you would take pictures of her, you would record her. She was such an amazing Southern storytelling, charming woman with a huge, huge personality. Everyone loved her. And so I always wanted to know her stories and I would record her, and then she'd get mad about it. And when I brought my baby to meet her the year before she died, and I took, God, all these videos of them playing together. Someone stole my video camera on the way home in Boston. I thought, of course, because mom kind of did want to be captured in a weird kind of way. And she was very private. Even though she would reveal things, she just didn't want to be pinned down. And so how does this poem reflect my relationship to her? I think she probably would like it to be a little bit more earthy and accessible to a larger audience with real stories about her doing stuff. But this is who she gave birth to. So, and her other sister, Sky Power, is also an abstract painter. I think we're both more inclined towards representations of feelings and ideas that are not necessarily in forms that other people can recognize, because they're kind of unique to the moment of having them. So I think abstractions do work for both of us. But there are a few poems in here, like A Very Fragile Radio Wave and some other poems that have objects.
Yeah, well, that was the next. My next question was, more of the objects that may be sung are in the poem A Very Fragile Radio Wave. Would you care to read that?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you want me to.
I do.
I feel like I'm talking a lot, but okay.
Well, that's the purpose of the podcast. That's the purpose of the interview. I read your book. I get to know you a little bit. I do a little bit of research on you. And then I ask you questions and we hear what you say about it. I think that's the purpose of it. I mean, if people want to hear me, there are many venues for that. And of course, they get a sense of my world, the way I shape how this is done. But this is your moment to tell us about what it is you do. To put out your first book of poems when you're 60 years old or whatever, to me... Huh. There's something extremely noteworthy in that. I mean, the general feeling in this community is, look at me, rush to publish. Here I got published. Look at me, this kind of thing. And not publishing for until you're 60 years old seems to me very much an antithesis of that. So it seems to me that there's some juice there, is what I'm trying to say.
Agreed in that a lot of the, the fame-focused, publication, or the publication is an auction of the mind, right? As Emily Dickinson said, is antithetical to what's stirring in you when you write a poem.
It's also antithetical to your own Buddhist practice, because. As our my teacher says all the time, do you know what causes your suffering? Your ego.
Yeah, it's so true. Isn't that the truth?
It's the truth.
And yet we have one. And so I like Pema Chodron's idea that, you've got this thing, it's messy, it's very neurotic. And so that's the form that you can dissolve into the emptiness. Work with it. Don't get mad at it. Well, and so I get some mad at some egos in this particular poem. They're militaristic egos, but it's called A Very Fragile Radio Wave, written in tercets. All I have is your hummingbird letter opener, broken now by clumsy misuse, then oversignified to amplify the gap between the living and the dead. I leave this room of objects that bind me to the broken, swerve around plots of American flags, private sidewalks, guarded eyes, fencing and what is theirs on the 4th of July. Repair to the garden of my friend, Anna's hummingbirds, your favorite, tussle for the blue hydrangea. Everything returns me to you, a very fragile radio wave I tune into now. Radio free you, if I'm lucky. Streaming beyond punctuated time of life, death, to feel the emptiness, you need the form. And when the form is gone, I need new guises to remind me how to talk to what is missing as though it's not. Conjure a continuum of plenty without resorting to spiritual procrastination. See you in heaven, etc. We scribble poems as planes straight to the redwoods compete with monster truck song. Further afield, the cement white skies of Lincoln Plaza, rigor mortis with black jets. Words fly across shadows on our pages. My finger, ringed by the turquoise you left, curls around the pen that writes toward you as you recede. One hummingbird is made whole by the flowering maple. We brush against our own signals and listen for further instructions.
A very fragile radio wave I tune into now. Yeah. I mean, it's evocative of Jack Spicer saying that poets are radios tuned to stations from Mars. But can you talk to us? Right? Isn't it?
Like, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not suggesting, you know, your mom is in a Martian or like that, but
or Spicerian
or that either. But it seems to be a similarity. But what I'm interested in is. Is that how she comes to you now? Is that how she comes to you or how she has come to you after her death?
Yeah. I guess I'll just be real and say yes. Every now and then, I'll get caught off guard by just glancing at an object. It's often an object that she owned, but not always. And I'll just feel like, oh my God, this presence of mom or my sister Cleo in it. And unless I sit there with it, with my mind unlittered by conceptual thinking and just be with that presence, it goes away really fast and it will not come back. And it feels, and I might be projecting here because that might all be projection, like it took an enormous amount of effort to make that appearance. And so for that to come back, I mean, it could be that, again, the projection could be my understanding, if that's what it is, of how presence works after death in the Buddhist terms, which is a kind of mind stream of particles of karma, as opposed to a soul, which is coherent and inherent, like, you know, an essentialized being. And so what I'm trying to tune into is something that is very subtle. And trying might be the wrong word because I believe it just happens often. Mm-hmm. Transmissions, it could, you know, sometimes I could make them funnier. Like one of my favorite movies is by Jean Cocteau, Orphée. Do you remember that? When Orpheus, the French nationalist poet who is having a writer's block, is tuning into the radio wave in the basement by Dionysus and death. And they're writing really interesting surreal poetry and saying it in a radio, and he's just copying it down plagiaristically.
I think that's where Spicer
that's where
got the idea.
Poetry comes from. Oh yeah,
I think so.
Like I have a lot more to learn about Spicer. In fact, I might take a class on him with Elizabeth Robinson soon. To be deserving of my desire to be affiliated with the Bay Area poetry scene, you have to know a bit more about Spicer than I do.
When your mom comes to you like that, is that similar to the way poems appear in your head?
I have to say that somebody, the person whose garden I visited in this poem, is kind of responsible for setting me in motion. And there were so many years of me doing all the stuff I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, like labor activism, parenting, and events and publications of anthologies, that finally when I started hanging out with my friend Chopsy, who is just very much about, you have your friends in poetry groups and workshops that you read your finished poems to, and then you have your friends that are generative, and she's very generative. So she just says, let's sit down and write for 11 minutes. I don't know why 11. So over a bunch of years, I just reestablished this habit of writing. And it's not like I'm waiting for inspiration, but we just sit down and we write. And in that inspired salon-like atmosphere that we turn almost every place that we wander into, and it's usually nature, into, then it will come, then things like this will come to me. And I might have a tendency to look at objects and project onto them like most poets do. I leave this room of objects that bind me to the broken, that broken hummingbird letter opener that I start with. Probably a little magical thinking there. I project, oh my God, I broke my mother's favorite letter opener and she loves hummingbirds and I did it. Ah! You know, so then I have to make something of it that is, turns it, turns it into a, something a little bit more whole.
You can't use your environment for poetry.
Well, that's what Jory Graham said. And it's interesting because I often would write, not that I want to preempt all of the things that you're going to ask me to do, but you mentioned this poem, Evidence. And I was going to say, that's funny. You should mention that poem, Paul, because that's a space up in Northern Colorado on the border of Wyoming where James Galvin lived. And I'd sometimes not herd cattle, but ride horses with my cattle girlfriend, Billy Best, who herded cattle with him. But he was married to Jory Graham for a while, and they were up there writing poems in which, he was very much writing about his environment, but she was pretty much writing philosophically about how one should not use one's environment for poetry. And so that's where that comment comes from.
What's the logic behind that?
Well, I think the kind of utilitarian, or I guess that's not the right way of looking at it, or using that word utilitarian, to use usury is not the right word either. I think the commodification of one's environment, even by people who call themselves eco-activists, I'm noticing a lot of my most admired friends and so forth are wanting very much to be known as environmental activists. And that's kind of a form of commodifying your own identity through your reverence of the environment. If you use something to increase your professional status, whether it's a poet or an activist. So to me, using your environment in that regard is just part of capitalism in some ways. And so I think that you can follow the cry of the occasion, as well as Stephen said, of an object in your environment, see where it takes you. But that's a little bit more like I say in my final poem of the book, letting the winds whistle through you as though you're a reed, and let the thing out there be bigger than you and play you, rather than you harnessing it for your own purposes. But I'm sure it's okay to use. I mean, very few people read poetry anyway, so you may as well, in the service of reading something that people will read, use your environment. I don't know. So the environment that I use, I guess, and I don't know if you want to talk about that poem. Is that one you wanted to talk about?
You could read Evidence. That's a very fine poem. It's one I had lined up as potentially to be read, page 44. You know, one of the other themes of the book is dealing with the catastrophic wildfires. And, you know, we live here in the very beginning of the Anthropocene. And I think that in the future, you know, if there is a future, and I'm optimistic that there will be one, people are going to say, how did they deal with it? How did they deal with the daily, you know, fear of losing their house or losing their loved ones or driving across the country, having to turn back because something else was on fire? So I think it's important. I think it's an important poem.
Yeah. I mean, you've written yourself a lot of very, and said a lot of meaningful things just about air quality. And so I think that the loss of homes is very much secondary to our ability to breathe. But there's a series of fire poems in this book that Mostly revolve around the CZU Lightning Complex fire, which broke out in my neighborhood in the Santa Cruz Mountains and got a few blocks from our house. And I started writing while I was in Wyoming, where I was brought up. My daughter wrote me and said, "There's a fire right next to our house, and please come home, Mama." And so I started driving towards her and got all the way to Elko, Nevada. And she said, "There's no point. It's going to be a long, long burn." And they left for South Carolina. So then I started zigzagging, which is the movement of fire, the way that fire moves, across the Rocky Mountain West, because I have a lot of friends in Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, looking for a place to be. While I was in Colorado, it might have been the same summer, but there is this place that I was alluding to that James Galvin, he lives in Tai Siding, and close by is a ranch that I repaired too, and I wrote this poem looking around at the Medicine Bow Range and started thinking about the bigger story of how we came to the Anthropocene in 50 short years in many ways since denying the facts of that were presented to us, not only in the 1980s, facts about that Exxon and others knew, but really thinking about the kind of defensive anger leveled against people who were looking at materialism in the 1960s. So I'm trying to make those connections. Should I just read it? Okay. It's called Evidence. Same haze from multiple fires in Colorado, soften the outlines of Phantom Canyon. No snowpack melt, no rain in this baked bone of a state. Fires bring brome weed and yarrow, pig grass and cheat grass into glowing green relief against the smoke. Vista stepped back from the fire that burned our Redwood Valley a year ago, sat atop the same atoll, turning the Medicine Bow Mountains into metaphor. Think of the 60s, half century slice of anger, pulling up every drop of crude. Culture wars burn steady, a refinery flame, now explode in the big lie. Strophe and anti-strophe, a fire, dance across any stage now, a chorus telling us the story of ourselves across one short generation. We knew in the 80s, now we know we knew. ExxonMobil records locked away so they could offer us freedom of mobility in exchange for a shrug. Chorus isn't wise so much as angry. Slept away a half century of hope. How we look when we teach each other new refrains of extinction blues. I want to learn all the names of wildflowers surrounding me. I want to say at least I've tried.
What a great ending. I just love that. I love that so much. Yeah. I can't imagine.
You know, it's weird.
I can't imagine dealing with that. I mean, I know it happens. I see it. Maybe I think that's in California. We having fires here in this state. We get smoke. One summer, there were ashes from old growth forests settling in the spider webs around our house. It was very much an image of, you know, climate disorder, Anthropocene, however you want to say it. But that ending too. Stunning. Yeah, and you say 50 years, and I'm thinking, well, that's way in the past. And I realize, you know, we were there, we were living, we were thinking this, everything was normal the way it was. And well, what is normal anyway? Yeah, powerful.
No, I doubt we were, Paul. I bet you weren't either. I mean, I'm sure that in the 80s, when small cars and lower speed limits were popular, we were very much aware of, you know, the ecological movements of the 70s. What was really surreal was when the 90s came along and everything got supersized, from mansions to cars to SUVs to talk radio to this, you know, stream of lies, basically, about facts, and especially the environment. So what's that all about? Our desire to have comfort at the sake of, forsaking the future, forsaking the people who will be in the future. So
I blame pig grass.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I don't even know what pig grass is. I just underlined that as an interesting image.
I think I'm going to blame Cheatgrass. That sounds more like it. It's yeah, well, that'll take over. After fire, there are certain kinds of, you know, things that grow that are not necessarily what you want. And that's one of them.
Yeah.
In the Rocky Mountain West, anyway, close to Fort Collins, which is kind of where I consider, if I have to choose a place on the map of the world, my heart's home.
Yeah. On page 46, we start so many parties by accident, just two pages later. It's a fine poem. The title comes from a line halfway into the poem. And I wonder how you title your poems. You write it, and then you look back and say, that's the essence of it, or that sounds good. Or how does it work for you?
Yeah, I wish I could say give you a more creative answer than I'm searching for one of the best lines in the poem to bring forward. But I also think it's part of my curation technique, that whether or not it's subtitles to the section, like unpaint a landscape, I'm looking for a way to orient the reader to a gallery in a way of rooms that these poems exist in. So this exists in the section of the Anthropocene crises. And I'm trying in some ways, I guess, I don't know about trying, but I have kind of morbid sense of humor. Everybody wanted me to call this Mary's Child after Mary Shelley's Child, which is her book in a way, and about Frankenstein. But it just seems like I'll let you decide whether or not you think this title works. Shelley felt herself the creature responsible for her mother's death. Well, let me start by saying, you know, that Shelley's mom died giving birth to her, right? Shelley felt herself the creature responsible for her mother's death, though she didn't ask to be that demon. I never asked to be born, we all scream. But now that we're all here, all 8 billion of us, shall we seek revenge on our thoughtless progenitors? Okay, boomer, now what? Do you not owe me the same portion of happiness you took? A mate, a job, an oxygen mask? We start so many parties by accident, ways to avoid loneliness, to not look at the shimmer of red maple leaves before they fall to the ground in a storm of wet endings. The lilac blooms for a week. The cherry blossoms clichéically short, though a new metaphor is needed now that they bloom in January. If we stop spreading ourselves like seed bombs across the graying crust of everything, we could tend to those creatures here, now. We invest in immortality when these drops of rain, these birds, half of them gone forever, fly in our sky now. Miracles that took forever. Not to be depressing, I was trying to say that, you know, these parties that we start by accident, it's almost like a tipping point, right? We kind of normalize ways of behaving, which involve a lot of consumption that basically takes us emotionally away from feelings of vulnerability, kind of like parties do. You just want to go with a crowd and you want to enjoy yourself, you want to consume. And so it's understandable. But then look what has happened by accident. We didn't mean to ruin the world.
We could tend to these creatures here now, miracles that took forever. These seem to me to be very Buddhist concepts. And Dogen noted about 800 years ago that miracles are practiced 3,000 times in the morning and 800 times in the evening. What constitutes a miracle for you? I mean, you outlined a few things, the lilac blooms, the red maple leaves, the cherry blossoms. Can you talk about miracles?
When I'm really focused on it, it's this precious human life that we've been given, to be able to use this frontal cortex, which took so many millions of years to evolve, that is the seat of self-consciousness and of reason. It's an ability to make decisions based on what is predictably going to happen to this one planet that we know. So to me, a miracle is that evolution, and it took a hell of a long time. And I know that, yeah, maybe impermanence is such that Buddhist monks will create a beautiful sand mandala and then wipe it out with their hand to show the impermanence of everything. But to get there and cause so much suffering, needless suffering, unnecessary. I think a miracle is also when you have people actually working together, as activists to change that motion, what feels like inevitability, that hopelessness, that, oh, well, looks like we're on this train. Guess we're just going to have to ride it to the end and be, eco-tourists and go to Iceland before it melts. It's like, well, we can make different decisions. And I think the miracle is when people are counter-evolutionary in their thinking and they are future-focused. That's a little bit of a miracle, but also just, God, red maple leaves, cherry blossoms, lilacs. These did not come from our stupid head, from our prefrontal cortexes. Those are miracles that we can't even explain. They're so gorgeous. They're all over the place where you live.
I had a red maple leaf right next to my desk before the handyman came in and fixed my drawer. And I was going to reach down and get it, but it's gone now.
Oh.
Yeah, I saved it.
Yeah, aren't they? They're really amazing.
I've been sketching leaves this fall, doing spiritual ecology work. And I have a relationship with leaves now that I never had before. There's a reference to Charles Simic. You studied with him, yes. So Jory Graham, Charles Simic, Cecil Giscombe. What was it like with Simic?
Yeah. Simic's poem, Crooked Heart, wherever that is that was after he died, but I just studied with him in the summer of 1990, I think, at Aspen Writers Conference. I thought I was going to study with Carolyn Forshay. There wasn't room in her workshop. So I got put in a workshop with someone that I thought was very dark. I thought, damn it. But it, like so many things in my life, it turned out to be perfect because he kind of like slapped me out of my too serious, confessional, sad, sack mode of looking at things that are not going well in the world and said, okay, well, yeah, I've been through the Yugoslavian, Serbian wars, and I can still find some funny little surreal things. So he kind of moved me toward a surrealistic bent. I totally kept up with it, but I tried. The other thing that I'm not so good at that he did, he's sort of more Edgar Allan Poe-ish, not only in his dark view of things, but in his assumption that readers' attention will only cohere for about 20 lines, small lyric poems. He was good at those. He was also very inter-artsy. I published him an epic. His poems about Joseph Cornell's boxes were like little boxes themselves, the weird arrangements of objects that he would put, juxtaposed strange objects in his poems. So I would that's kind of fun, to try to write a poem like somebody else, to try to write a poem like Simic, would be to find things that are strange and haunting, like the cat that appears in the poem on page 87, Crooked Heart, that scared my mom, or the butcher who married my best friend who had gnomes in her backyard. So I tried to use these objects. Again, the letter opener appears that has a crooked heart in it. But none of that makes any sense to your listeners if they haven't heard the poem. So,
well, they would have to, they'd have to go to the book. They'd have to go to that, the book, finishinglinepress.com. Sure. I think There to Protect the Song might be the one to end on, though.
Sure.
And it might be just outside the Simic range, but it's a shorter one.
Do you remember what page it's on?
88.
Searching. Thank you. There are a lot of birds in this book. I think this poem has some birds in it. Okay, There to Protect the Song. First, listen to the birds. Next, figure out which birds. Surrounded in the morning, numerous as sound, yet punctuated by particularity. That ringing in the deep bones of childhood, American robin. That long distant trill like Coltrane, punching in when it matters, flycatcher. Was he ever? And like the back back up, doo-wop, here and gone, chestnut chickadee, dark-eyed junco struts in, pygmy nut hatch goes nuts, everyone on their own perch taking in the difference. Even my dog, yapping, gets his solos till whisked off stage by the doorman who was there to protect the song. A little moment of levity. You know, and it is, I think that is the most hypocritical poem in the whole book, because as Jory said, don't use your environment. I was like, oh, okay, let me press this little app I have called Merlin where you can identify bird songs, because I'm just not one of those people who can hear something, hear a bird and go, oh, there's that pygmy nut hatch again. So I want to learn, and I'm learning. So I'm pretty sure that I used my environment for that particular poem, all right? Not to mention the technology that I'm always dissing, like Victor Frankenstein creating a creature. But yeah, thanks, Paul. You chose some poems that I would never have thought to read, so that was refreshing.
That's the way it goes sometimes.
You always surprise me.
Roxy, what a joy it is to know you and to hear your work and to read your book. And I wish you all kinds of success and safety from fires and every evil thing. Thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure to be here and in your mini classes. Everybody, sign up for one of Paul's classes on CascadiaPoeticsLab.org. You've got a new one coming up, right, on your Cascadia Zen book next month. He's a great teacher. Thank you, Paul, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Roxy.
Cascadian Prophet supporters include Diana Elser, a sponsorship dedicated to her parents, whose practicality, humor, and love of family life reflected their experience in and love for the Missouri Breaks and Ruby Valley, Montana landscapes that define their childhoods. And Steinbrook Native Gallery, located near Pike Place Market in downtown Seattle, featuring fine art of the Northwest Coast from emerging and established artists. A link to their site at cascadianprophets.org. Cascadian Prophets is a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, founded in 1993. More interviews and lots of information on our website, cascadianprophets.org.